Welcome to the Penny Bloom Podcast. Ain't another place that has got more bombast. Run past your mom, dad's listening to Tomcast. Talking everything that make you sad. We don't want that. We're here to make you smile. Put your mind at ease. Peace, love, and bloom, and always praise Keanu Reeves. This what we about. Get some weed and now. We'll talk until we can't no more, and then we peacing out. Alright, let's go. Penny Bloom Podcast. It's the Penny Bloom Podcast. Penny Bloom Podcast. It's the Penny Bloom Podcast. Penny Bloom Podcast. Penny Bloom Podcast.
Penny Bloom.
Hello, everybody, and welcome in to the final episode of Winter is Blooming, our Game of Thrones rewatch podcast, which is concluding today. We're capping off a wonderful year and a half with a 5x5. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with our 5x5 format, it's something we've done a few times here on the podcast. We've done it for Star Wars, I think, a couple times now. We've done it for Marvel stuff. We've done it for a few things. Let me see. We did it for Valentine's Day. We did it for Halloween last year. Yeah, we've done 4 or 5 Star Wars, live action comic book movies, Valentine's Day, and Halloween. So very broad spectrum. And this one is going to be our Game of Thrones 5x5. All the 5x5 is 5 top fives. Now, that typically sounds a bit lengthy, but we bent the rules a little bit for this 5x5. What it is that me and Joe each have a top five, and for it'll be top five favorite main characters, top five favorite supporting characters, top five favorite performances, top five favorite duos, and top five favorite episodes in Game of Thrones. And it's going to be a great deal of fun. We did bend the rules a little bit when it comes to main characters and performances. There's only one set of five that we agreed on. Versus all the other ones have, each of us get our own list. So with that, I'm Colton Robertson. I'm joined by Joseph George. What's up, homie?
Oh, what up, what up? Always a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and it's always a pleasure to have you. You ready to fucking 5x5, baby?
It is 11 in the morning, but I do have a glass of wine. I can't take advantage right now. So I figured why not? Proud. That is why. This is for Tyrion. This is for you. I wish it was made by him. You know, I wish it was his honeycomb and or whatever he'd call his wine. I don't know. Did he have a name for it?
Yes, he had a vineyard he wanted to like open up. I can't remember what it was, but you know, like that could be a nice Dornish red. You know, it could be.
Yeah, it is St. James from middle of nowhere Missouri, local for us. So. I don't know.
Jimmy. Gotta
it
love
felt
it.
Right. Yeah, it felt right.
Unfortunately, I can't take advantage. Fuck! God damn it. No, but if you're ready, we can go ahead and kick this bad boy off with our top five favorite main characters in Game of Thrones. We obviously took quite the journey with Game of Thrones. We got to know these characters better than we ever have before. A set of characters that we felt we already knew as well as we possibly could. And now here we are a year and a half later, having spent every week with them. Who are our top five favorite main characters from Game of Thrones? We will start from the bottom. We will work to the top. So the criteria here, the reason we separated main characters and supporting characters is because Game of Thrones has so many fucking characters. It's impossible to just pick your top five favorite characters because you end up going with main characters because you kind of have to. How are you going to not go with some of the main characters? But you got to shine a light on those supporting guys. So we're going to do that a little later, but we are going to start here with the main characters, which typically consist of nothing but, you know, Lannisters, Starks, Baratheons, and Baratheons kind of a stretch with some of them, you know, and Targaryens, you know, like those are the team. So, what's our five? You go ahead and kick us off.
I get to do the honors. Yes. Oh wow! Thank you. Season one alone is where this man comes from, and he haunts the show for the rest of the time So it only felt right to keep him in here. It is Ned Stark. He had to be in here. And tough. Once you get to four, that's actually like, I don't know, like three, I feel like, and above is like the different tier for mm-hmm. me personally. But like these two are still like it's incredible that Ned is here, and there's a lot of other characters that are just right below him that didn't quite make it. But we had to squeeze him in here, right?
Dude, Ned Stark, man. Yeah. That's Ned. That's Neddy boy. I love Ned. He's like you said, he's only in season one. He haunts the show for the rest of the time. The rest of the runtime, you know, it's one of my favorite characters in fiction. One of the most honorable men you've ever met. Just a really good guy. And I felt like in Game of Thrones, we
too honorable. Is yes. that a thing? Yes. You know, I think we've learned. I think that is the lesson of Ned Stark. Is that he honor is a good thing, and usually it does lead to, you know, to good things. But it did get him killed. You know, it did get him beheaded. Yeah.
And I think it's just the message isn't to be less honorable. You know,
but to be aware. Yeah. To be aware that your enemies won't be as honorable as you are, maybe. Mm-hmm. What a twist for the, you know, first season. Like, I remember when I was first starting the show, I had no idea what was going to happen. I was so certain that Ned was safe. I'm like, this is the guy. I'm like, this is
ultimate episode going... Mm-hmm. They're going to figure a way out of this. I don't know what it is, but they're going to figure it out.
Like, I had no clue, and I'm like, yeah, he's obviously the main guy. And then, like, until the sword hit his neck, I'm like, well, someone will stop it. You know, like, he's still not going to die. Like, obviously, his neck is maybe made out of steel.
Egregious amounts of denial emanating off the viewer during that. And
he's dead. Died, was crazy. But then, yeah, arguably he started the events of the rest of the show. You can say Littlefinger, whatever, if you want to get like nitty gritty. But like Littlefinger used Ned to kind of start everything. Almost, I don't know. It was just perfect play.
It's a lot. But yeah, Ned coming in at five felt right, you know, and he's, like you said, only one season. There's a lot of characters who were in all the seasons who did not come above Ned. So that's just how much we love Neddy boy. I will give us our number four. Mm-hmm. It's the man you're honoring today with that glass of wine there. He drinks and he knows things.
Yes.
Tyrion Lannister.
The Imp's Delight.
Yes, wonderful. Tyrion Lannister, man. Now this is to come in at four as Tyrion Lannister speaks volumes to the quality of character that we are to come to, because Tyrion is one of the most thoroughly well-written characters in the entirety of television, in that entire medium, you know. And when we say things like that, we're excluding a notable exception in an entire season of the show. It's up to that point, one of the most exquisitely well-written characters ever. I think that to have created or to have taken this character that is depicted in the public eye in the universe as a monster, as a monstrosity, as this terrible entity, as this horrible person, and make him one of the most likable characters in this entire show. Really, really just and Peter Dinklage is in part to owe for that, but god damn do I love me some Tyrion, man.
He's funny, he's smart, he's like, he has a good moral compass on him. He does make some decisions that are, you know, for his family that you could say aren't the most morally correct, whatever. But like, nah, that's mainly at the end. I don't know. I had some crazy theories of Tyrion too, you know, that maybe he's sort of like Jon and Tywin had some similar situation where he had to keep a secret of who Tyrion was for some reason, but it falls apart pretty quickly when you just start to think, I don't know, like, but you know, similarities, like Lyanna dies whenever Jon is born, and Jon is, you know, the bastard thrown away and meant to be kept a secret. Tyrion's mother dies at birth, maybe to keep that secret, you know, locked down, you know, so I don't know. I've gone down the rabbit hole with Tyrion, but what I can say for sure is the character we got, the Lannister, you know, I think, I don't know. It doesn't matter really who he is.
The only Lannister on this list.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The only Lannister that I guess Cersei maybe has a chance. You know, she's probably the closest. Definitely. I mean, over Jaime. That's
I like Cersei a hell of a lot more than I like Jaime. No, yeah, and that's what's fascinating, you know? Like, when it comes to favorites, I think that Cersei is one of the best characters in this show. You know? She's definitely not one of my favorite characters in this show. You know, like, I don't love her. I don't root for her.
No,
I do find her fascinating. I think she's, again, extremely well written. I think her conniving nature is wonderful. And I think that Tyrion overcoming all of his familial attributes and being a good guy is something that he was not meant to do. And the fact that he does makes him all the more worthy of being one of my favorites in the entire show.
Yeah, the true hero of Blackwater that'll never be written down in the history books, not even until he got Hand of the King with Bran Stark. Now he will be written. And we're remembering him here. So he's in recorded history as well. Tyrion, don't you worry. You are the most famous imp in the world.
When we publish Winter is Blooming across Westeros, they'll know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We gotta spread the word. You know, I think there is a line. Maybe it is my favorite Tyrion line of all time. And it is, no, Varys, the most famous imp in the world. Very meta line, very true, actually in real life.
Most famous dwarf in the world.
Dwarf, yes. Yeah. He did not. Oh, imp. I'm stuck on Imp's Delight, I think. Delight. But no, dwarf in the world, yeah, but man. Love me some Tyrion. And yeah, was the one at the end that's like, hey, why don't we pick a king? And that was never done before. Just to put that forth. So bro
created oligarchy.
Whoa. You know, that crucial step. Almost like a human evolution of sorts. But true. Yeah, true. Love that man. I'll drink to you, Tyrion. To beat out Ned Stark, that's no easy feat.
It's an impressive achievement. But how about you go ahead and give us our number three top five?
Okay. Yeah, number three. This is where I said the tier kind of changes for me a little bit. And this is a Stark, and it is Arya Stark, the Night King killer. She is Arya Stark. Trained to be no one. Trained by Syrio Forel, Jack and Hagar. The Hound, kind of. Trained with Brienne for a little bit, even. Killer of Walder Frey. Yeah, true that. I got the kill list here, actually. We can just go down it. Random boy stabbed in the chest with needle. Yep, first kill. She killed a pigeon for food, snapped its neck. That was all of season one. Season two, she created her list. She started saying the names. And the Mountain and Polliver were added to the list. She didn't kill them. But then the Tickler, the Tickler by Jack and Hagar. What is the Tickler?
The Tickler was the guy who tortured people at Harrenhal.
Okay. So Arya giving the first name to Jaqen was the tickler, and then Armory Lorch was the second name Arya gave Jaqen. Amory, thank you. She thought about Tywin for a little bit, I guess, in episode 7.
No, she actually throws out the name Tywin, and he's like, and Jaqen goes, yeah, I can't do that. That's the one I can't do. Sorry about that.
Oh, shit. Okay. Oh, wow. I and then on episode 8, I have Jaqen H'ghar, but crossed out. Oh, she does. She does.
She
named
Jaqen H'ghar.
Jaqen H'ghar. Yeah, there you go. And then, but I guess for actual kills, let's see.
A girl gives a man his own name.
Man who stowed Rob's head. Yeah. She did kill that guy. The guy who... So yeah, I'm the one who sewed.
I'm the one who did that shit. Yeah,
oh really? Yeah. Thank you. Arya's like, oh cool.
Not to you. You're gonna fucking die.
Polliver got it, and random asshole as well. Whoever that is, Roar.
Yeah, her and the Hound.
Yep.
You know, that's where the heart is. I believe.
Okay. Good lesson. Mm-hmm. Roar. And Mockingbird. Whoever. Roar is. Not coming
that
to me.
That actually might be the "this is where the heart is" lesson, if I recall correctly.
Okay, people coming for the bounty for the Hound.
Yeah, because Polliver was in the chicken, the place where they're eating the chicken, and they're giving Hound shit.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, "Oh shit, it's you!
Yep.
What's up, man?" You know, and then they go in and she does the whole sticks the sword in his throat the way that he did to the other kid.
Okay,
so yes, Rorge is the "this is where the heart is." I believe he's actually a good dude. He's the guy who's laying there dying.
And like nothing, maybe nothing is better than this or whatever.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, yeah, okay. Wow. Okay, yeah.
I might be mistaken.
Maybe. But if it is that guy, good guy.
We're remembering a lot of good stuff here. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another pigeon.
Gotta have one.
In season 5, it looks like. Meryn Trant. That's a good one. The Woo-hoo! Eyeballs and the, oh yeah. Good kill there. Love that one. The Waif. Good kill.
Yes.
Lady Crane. Not Lady Crane? Why do I have Lady Crane and then not Lady Crane in the episode after? Was it someone appearing as Lady Crane?
She was supposed to kill Lady Crane and decides to not kill Lady Crane.
Okay, maybe that's it.
She kills the Waif.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the Waif is...
The Waif
Waif was the thing I had in there was just whenever she was on her kill list. Like she was like, now I will kill you. Now you will die. Not actually
probably.
Dead yet.
Probably.
Maybe.
Yeah,
but
Lady
I don't have
Green
the Waif
dies
anywhere
in the hands
else.
Of the Waif.
Yeah. So and then okay, there is the Waif, episode 8. Yes, okay. So then there is the Waif's actual death. So okay. And then Walder Frey, a big one. The rest of House Frey, minus the wife, the only one to make it out.
Mm-hmm.
Good on her. Hot Pies Pie.
Dominates that shit.
Yeah. Brienne of Tarth's reputation, whenever she comes into Winterfell. And, yep.
Yeah.
Her storyline, oof, in episodes. Yep. Littlefinger, good one.
Right,
her virginity, huge with Gendry. The Night King and the entire army of the dead. Gotta give her that one.
That's off to you.
Gendry's heart, I put in there. after he got turned down. Revenge, after learning the lesson from the Hound. And that shit was the last addition we put in there because she killed that shit. And so yeah, I guess long side road to say that she deserves, you know, she's in the top three of characters.
I mean, like, she goes on one of the most fulfilling journeys of any character in the show, you know, from the beginning where she is, you know, she's not a lady, you know, she refuses that title, she doesn't want to be a lady, and by the end of the show, after all the training she's undergone, she fulfills it by killing death.
Yeah. What do we say to the god of death? Not the god of death, really.
Death.
What do we say to death today? Yeah, she looked death right in the face and hit one of the nice little... Yeah, no, it was clean. Man in the Noise, too. The sound design of that moment. Yeah. The, like, ringing of the dagger, you know, kind of. Like,
splintering of the icy glass. Ooh. Yeah, that was hard. That was hard. No, I love me some Arya, man. And the way she wants to protect her family, the way she wants to protect everything she loves and cares about. Mm. And when she realizes what's important there, it's beautiful. So, love Arya Stark at 3. And we're on to our top 2 characters of the show, and these will come as no surprise. It's just sure that may surprise some, and if you've been listening to the show, probably not. Our top 2 at 2 is Daenerys Targaryen, the Mother of Dragons, the Unburnt, Queen of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm up until she's no longer the Protector.
The Destroyer. Of one of, I guess, a kingdom. Partially a kingdom. Yeah, Breaker of Chains, another one in there. Let's see, what other? I feel like she had some other titles. The Unburnt, maybe.
I threw that out. Stormborn.
Yeah, okay, yep, there you go. That's... Anything in Karth? Did she gain anything from Koth?
I don't know.
I don't think so. But anyway.
I don't think so.
Yeah, quite. You know, she...
Khaleesi.
Big one. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, no, I love Daenerys, man, and it's a shame that they couldn't have finished her story up in a more satisfying way. I've aired it out plenty, if you actually listen to the show, about how I think the Fallen Angel arc works for her, but they didn't do it in a satisfying way. She loved... the people she loved so fucking deeply, that whenever they're hurt or they betray her or she perceives them to be turning against her, she flips. And that, man, it's Anakin Skywalker right there. So, like, it works. It's perfect. The idea is great. It's just that, it's a fumble. It's a fumble there at the end. But for several seasons, she's an inspiration. She's an absolute treasure of a character, and
everyone falls in love with her. Literally everyone, because how couldn't you? It's, you know, she, why couldn't she just stay in Essos? You know, she had a great thing going. You know, at least if she was burning people, these were the right people to burn.
Yeah,
you know, there is some
masters and, you know, all that stuff. Like, that's basically the only people she massacred when she was over there were people who owned people.
You know, I'm still never going to advocate for such a thing. You know, I will still say it. Like, it is nice to not have to do that. But if she's going to,
you're going to kill them, motherfucker. They better own people. Yeah.
In Essos, it was good. You know, we, like Tyrion said, we cheered her on, and it kind of made sense to cheer her on there, though. But then. Yeah, once she got to Westeros, things just
comfortable in her rightness.
Things just kind of changed when she got to Westeros. She needed to stay over in Essos, and everything.
People loved her there, man. And the people who didn't were the people who, I mean, inevitably, there's probably, I mean, it's just people who were attracted to the old ways, the way they used to do things. And she she represented a change. She represented an evolution in their people, you know. And frankly,
the change needed to happen.
Going to Westeros,
like,
it's fascinating to think that her going to Westeros is born from, it's not presented like this at the time, but it's born from a place where she's planning on conquering the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because arguably the most change that needs to happen is in Essos.
Yeah.
It's not in Westeros. It's like Westeros, although a lot of change needs to happen, you know, to get like to our present current standards, whatever. But as far as the world's concerned, Essos needs changing, and Dany was doing it. She was doing it everywhere she went, and it was, people were, I don't know, there was hope again for the people in Essos, but. But yeah, it is a beautiful character. I think, you know, I'm thinking of ways to possibly end her arc, as, you know, kind of the thought experiment we're having, for this, at, you know, and I maybe have thought where maybe she comes to Westeros and actually realizes that, like, this isn't her calling anymore. Like, everything's off here. Everything's off. So she actually does return to West or Essos, but a lot of other things wouldn't happen. That changes a whole lot.
When it comes to creating conflict and creating tension, there's only so much you can do to make a good TV show.
Yeah.
Not a ideal life for the characters.
Yeah.
I mean, an ideal life, Ned Stark doesn't go south, you know?
Damn.
Ned Stark stays in the north. He doesn't accept Hand of the King as something else happens. And, you know, like all that. So we could play that game all day long, you know? And I think that
Bran doesn't climb that tower.
Bran doesn't climb the tower. Jaime doesn't fuck his sister. You know, there's
that
all sorts
help.
Of stuff.
Yeah.
Robert doesn't love Lyanna. You know, Lyanna and the Mad King isn't fucking mad. You know, we could do this all day. It goes back and back. But in a perfect world, you know, I like to think Dany could have ruled over Essos and been a beloved, good, just ruler. You know,
they could have conquered the world. John leading in Westeros. But I do like John north of the wall and actually not leading, you know, him leading just the north people, the Starks leading everywhere else. But man, it could have been a beautiful world. They were almost
Targaryens there. Could have ruled the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, they could have. And if my theory is to be believed, you know, Tyrion maybe a secret Targaryen, technically the hand, the true ruler of the capital right now. Anyway, I'll stop.
I love Dany, man, and she deserved better. Emilia Clarke deserved better. And I think that that was such a lovable character for so long, such strength and presence that very few characters came even close to being as good as Daenerys. So there's only one, as we've stated here. So how about you give me the number one character in the show for us?
I mean, we know who it is. If you're visibly seeing me, you know, it's Jon Snow. He is that guy. Part of me wants to call him Aegon Targaryen. But then it feels wrong because I don't even feel like he likes to be. He hates that name, you know. I feel like he.
Oh yeah, I mean, like I think that the show makes a, you know, makes a point to make clear that he's not Aegon Targaryen. He rejects the name. He rejects the title. He rejects everything that comes with it. He's Jon Snow. You know, that's my man, Jon Snow.
Now, Maester Aemon is kind of exactly in the same situation John's in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John grows old. He becomes Maester Aemon. He's going to be at the Night's Watch. You know, maybe he'll be Lord Commander, or who knows? Maybe he just stays north the whole time. It doesn't even fuck with the Night's Watch. I'd probably prefer that.
I mean, the Night's Watch is a sham now. They basically just hang out at the fucking wall.
Oh, I guess they don't have a Night King. They don't have a threat.
They don't have anything. The Wildlings are cool now. They don't fight the Wildlings anymore. The Army of the Dead's gone. It's basically just a banish.
Yeah.
They're just like, go
there. I guess what I was trying to get at is it seems that the loop, that there is a loop and it's repeating, you know, sort of thing. That there is someone who very much did deserve the throne that is now at the wall, who's leaving all their titles behind, whatever. It's John, it's a Targaryen, you know, still John. Bran, the Three-Eyed Raven is now down. I guess I don't know how that loop would all work, because he'd have to go back north.
I believe that the loop had existed and now it's been broken.
It's broke, yes.
Been broken, and there are still characters who could have fulfilled those archetypes had it not been broken. You know, John could have gone on to that life. Bran could have stayed north of the wall and been the Three-Eyed Raven. You know, like Daenerys could have been the Mad Queen. Like these things could have repeated themselves, but they didn't. They did everything they could to stop that repetition. And I mean, Jon,
his rise, man.
Like, I love it. The fucking just he just keeps fucking climbing, man. He just keeps
to think of like his first moment. I guess like is it with the direwolves? I think it is. Like it's like, oh well, here's this the runt of the litter for you, John. Like that's yours, John. Like that's the first moment we have with him, and the end of the show, it is. You are the heir to the Iron Throne. You are that. You are we will follow you wherever you go. It doesn't matter, John. And this goes to Kit Harington in real life too. But like, if there's ever been a man that I would drop everything, I mean, instantly, I don't think there's any hesitation. In my mind, yes. Like, yeah.
I love that man. I love
yes.
him. He's wonderful. He's such a good dude. He takes everything Ned was and learns nothing from it.
Kind of falls for the same exact
falls for the same thing. Stuff.
But the on the way there, though, that's the thing, is that he did do some non-Ned things on the way there. Maybe, I don't know. I guess like storming north of the wall and just going to Mance Rayder, you know, being like, fuck it. You know, you guys aren't going to do shit. I'm going. I don't care if I die. This is the right, you know, it's the right thing. So it is still honorable of him to do so. Mm-hmm. But technically, he is a member of the Night's Watch and this is breaking his code to do, you know, whatever. So like, technically, it's not.
He abandons the Night's Watch after he dies.
No honor broken there. That's until my last, whatever the words are,
sure.
Whatever the words are, until my last breath or until my last days.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe it's last days. But in that lifetime, those were his last, you know, he did die.
Yeah, he died. No, I mean, I think it's fair.
But again, Ned might actually come back to life and be like, well, I'm still alive, so I have to stay in the Night's Watch.
Yeah.
Ned would, dude. Ned actually would.
That kind of guy. John, you know, fuck it. You know, and specific circumstances, you know, Ned becomes Lord Commander of the Night's Watch and he gets mutinied. Who knows? You know, that does something to somebody. It's not like you're like, well, I still love these guys, you know? It's definitely a complicated life, but John died. Bro died. You know, he was literally dead. And he comes back to life and he takes the North back. He wins the Battle of the Bastards, takes the North out from under the oppression of Ramsay Bolton and
goes on a suicide mission north of the wall to capture one wildling, which
one.
Now that I think about it. Sorry to the wildlings. That was, you know, at this point, you're very much past the White Walkers. That's for sure. But, you know, now that I think about it, if Dany was going to fly her dragon, you know, she didn't want to fly her dragon, but she did to go save them. Her, maybe just her, fly on a dragon, grab one, tie it. Drogon can literally grab it with his fucking foot and just care. Literally as easy as that. He could grab five. He's like a claw machine. Drogon could just go and just grab 15 in one of his feet and fly and drop them on Cersei's doorstep.
Could be, you know, they're
once dragons are in the game, they didn't know dragons were at risk yet. You know, there was no ice spear, that there was no, all the dragons were still alive. You know, and it was, they didn't want to risk Dany. They didn't want to risk her leaving. But it's like, if you don't want to risk all of these other people anyways, fly in and use your dragon claw machine and,
Hey, man, it is what it is. It is what it is. We get a pretty kick-ass episode out of it, and John's made it clear that ever since he died, he's kind of on a mission to do so again.
This is fair, you know. I am looking for the perfect world scenario, not for the TV conflict scenario.
The easy way is not the good TV way, you know. But you could make the argument that the way they did it wasn't the good TV way either. So,
yeah, but man. No, that's, I don't know. It was, when we started this list, it was clear who was number one. You know, yeah. that was clear. John was
there's
always
so many
there.
Characters we left out here. You know, we left out Cersei. We left out Jaime. We left out Sansa, Bran, tons of
Rob.
Rob was the main character for 3 seasons, you know. Yeah, Catelyn. I'd say Catelyn was a main character for every bit as long
Theon?
As Theon might be the top tier supporting mm-hmm. character.
Yeah, and you know, Samwell was kind of that.
The same Samwell tier, mm-hmm. where it's like, yeah. y'all aren't really main characters, but you aren't really supporting characters either. Like, mm-hmm. you have whole storylines dedicated to you, you yeah. know? So maybe they do qualify as main characters. Regardless, both fantastic characters. Love both those guys. Mm-hmm. Eventually, for Theon. Not for a while there for Theon. Eventually, you just feel
Reek
bad.
For a while there, you know, yeah, not like, even Theon.
Point. But yeah, then that makes yeah. our top 5 favorite characters from Game of Thrones: Jon Snow, Daenerys Targaryen, Arya Stark, Tyrion Lannister, and Ned Stark. And that's mm-hmm. a great collection there. Let's get on to supporting character, where we each have our own little list of 5, and we'll kind of blitz this a little bit. The first category took 45 minutes. So, mm-hmm. go ahead and ride. What's your 5 here?
Okay. My 5. I believe our 5s were actually swapped at one point, but then this was kind of like a last minute trade, but I'm very okay with it. And this is just, every time she's on screen, goddamn, I don't know if it's just funny or just badass, both, but what a presence. And it's Olenna Tyrell, the queen of Highgarden, you know, really. She's actually pulling the string. A queen of the Seven Kingdoms for a little bit, honestly. Yeah, for a little bit there. She was...
So the High Sparrow fucked shit up.
That's true. Yeah, High Sparrow really came in and fucked a lot of shit up. But Olenna, man, the only one who could kind of hold her own against Cersei... and Tyrion and Tywin, like against the big characters that Varys. Usually would slam we'll dunk figure. On everybody. Yeah. But it's rare that Olenna ever got dunked on herself. I'm trying to think of any time Olenna got dunked on. Like
the one who matched her was Tywin. Tywin was the only other guy who could even hold his own
mm-hmm.
against her. Varys kept getting sunned. Cersei didn't stand a fucking chance. Tyrion didn't even fucking try. He was like, nope, fuck it. Like, it was really only Tywin who, and basically all he can do is just go, I could kill you, you know? Like, that was kind of what his bag was. He was like,
yeah,
you guys could die. How about it? Mm-hmm. I love Olenna, though. And Diana Rigg was so fantastic at playing Olenna Tyrell. Absolute legend. Mm-hmm.
This Game of Thrones universe, Bene Gesserit. You know, she is the kind of even with the headpiece too a little bit, yeah. you know, kind of looks like it. But the one who's pulling the strings, using the feelings, using Margaery, you know, you doing all these things. She's very Bene Gesserit like. I don't know. I loved
was pretty Bene Gesserit like as well. But mm-hmm. my 5 comes with another O. Mm-hmm. We got Oberyn Martell, played by Pedro Pascal.
Man. Yeah, seeing those two names just next to each other, I don't have dyslexia, but like that just fucks my brain so hard. Like yeah. I want to say Olenna Martell and Oberyn Tyrell, like so bad. But anyway, sorry.
No, yeah, I love Oberyn. Love me some Oberyn. He finished in the top 5 for the count of most favorite character nominations.
Yes.
And he was in 7 episodes or 8 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe.
Yeah.
Only been 7.
Which.
So the dude God was damn. Memorable. He came in, he made a fucking statement. He was sexy. He just had fun. He was lovable. He had a good moral compass on his shoulders. He was just a good dude. A loving guy who just had to twist the knife and didn't know.
Hubris got to him, you know, what gave us quite the fight. That was quite the spectacle. But everything before that, though, man, he was, and I think we were also riding high off of, you know, we had The Mandalorian, but then, like, The Last of Us, I think, might have been coming out around the same time, or, like, before we got in.
Yes, The Last of Us season. Before we got to season four.
Yeah, so, like, we're riding high on Pedro. You know, Pedro Pascal is just that dude already. And then, like, we already knew he was that dude in Thrones, and we're like, oh, fuck yeah, now we get Oberyn. And, yeah, I mean, almost every episode, the dude got a character nod. He just came in and dominated. But yeah, man, I'm trying to, I know I had a line from him. This is a big and beautiful world. Most of us live and die in the same corner where we are born and never get to see any of it. I don't want to be most of us. Yeah, he was just, dude, man, the Rhaegar, you know, if there's a Rhaegar living that's not Jon Snow, it's Oberyn Martell. This is the Renaissance. Fuck, did I do it? No, I said Martell. I thought I said Ty. No, did I say Tyrell?
No, okay. You said Martell.
See, that's how even my brain, not in spoken word, I still get it fucked. But Oberyn's the closest to, like, a Renaissance man they got. He's a poet. He's a sex, you know, he's got sex down. I'd say, like, him and Podrick, that's like, I wonder who's won. You know, does Podrick beat out Oberyn?
Those are real eaters right there.
Like, Oberyn's got the experience, but Podrick's just got the natural raw talent,
natural,
I guess.
Ability, man.
So, what? I don't
know. You
know,
who knows? What's more important? I don't know. I'm not sure, but all I know is they're top two, you know? That's top two. And I loved Oberyn, man. And, you know, I do love Pedro Pascal, and that played a part in it, to be sure. But I don't think it mattered who played this character. I don't think a lot of people could have done as well as Oberyn as Pedro Pascal did as Oberyn. I want to make that clear. But the character is just so fucking laid bare. You know, like there's not a lot of gray area with Oberyn. You know who Oberyn is. He's very clear who he is. And goddamn,
he's on his mission
for it.
Yeah.
So I had to go Oberyn at five. What's your four?
Oh, yeah. Well, you did say kind of Bene Gesserit, more Bene Gesserit-like, and you're right. Combine these two together, and you have the Bene Gesserit. Olenna and Melisandre, the red woman, is my number four. And on previous watches, she wouldn't have even been on my radar really at all, other than, like, very attractive woman when you're, you know, like, I liked her. I thought she was an interesting character before, and she's gorgeous, obviously, but, like, this watch, the Lord of Light and the whole deity side of Thrones was just kind of crazy and, like, eye-opening, how, like, kind of undeniable it is for the show, and I just never paid attention to it before. And seeing her arc, like, kind of going, like, being very confident in her ways and doing what she does and then kind of having that loss of faith and then resurrecting Jon Snow and being like, oh, yeah. Never mind. Like, I kind of got it like that. But, and then especially, like, the only character I think in season 8 that I can confidently say that I have zero gripes with, like, her arc. Like, her just pulling up, knowing exactly what she needs to do, you know, being in the rooms where she needs to be, and, like, you know, even having that moment with Davos being like, oh, don't worry. Like, I'll be dead, but come tomorrow. Like, you don't have to worry about it. Like,
yeah.
I think, you know, even in season 8, I loved her, so.
Well, and she, you know, she's one of the people who gets to benefit from being in one episode of season 8.
I guess maybe that's why.
She's only in season 8, episode 3.
She does just show up, boom, I'm here, I'm doing what I need to do, and I'm dead. Damn.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I guess I haven't stepped back and looked at her season 8.
Cunt dies. That's Melisandre's life right
there.
Yeah.
200 years, I think, right? Is that the...
Yeah, something like that. She's an old lady. Old lady for sure. Yeah, I love Carice Van Houten as her too. She's very good, and she made such an impression for so long in the show. But yeah, I love Misa Melisandre, the Red Woman. Very, very important character. So a great little nod there for you there. Going with a different redhead for my four. A little more going on here. I'm going Tormund Giantsbane. I love me some Tormund, baby. He's such a I love the arc he goes on across from John, you know, and this is the very definition of a supporting character. Like, bro, he has his own arc, he has his own evolution, but it's always in service of John's story, you know, to show how much John has influenced him and to show how much he is changing. And to start as a full-blown wildling, no love for the crows, no love for any of them, and to, you know, kind of evolve it. He serves that line to John when he's thinking about bending the knee to Daenerys, and he's like, I can't do it. You know, I'm not going to. He's like, oh, you spent too much time with the free folk. But, you know, he asks how many people died because Mance didn't want to bend the knee, you know?
Yeah.
And just the way that he ends the show, I like to think that him and John are going off to be best buds, living forever.
You got together. The North, the real North in you. And I think maybe a little metaphorical and literal eventually, you know.
Yeah, you got the real North in you, me.
Think Tormund, that's what he's getting at. You know, he's just getting John ready. You know, he's like kind of priming him ready.
You're real intimate, man. I love me some John and Tormund. And I love, and again, just Tormund, John earning Tormund's trust and the way that he's like, I'll go to Hardhome with you, you know, like, because they're not, like, that's still in the process of proving himself to Tormund. Is like, we'll go up there together. You know,
yeah, I guess he put the arrow in Mance, and that was kind of like a good step in being like, okay, you know, like good, like thank you, and talking to, you know, because I guess Tormund was just a prisoner there at Castle Black for like a while, wow, but then
why should I trust you? You know, he's like, and then he unbuckles his restraints, and he's like, oh, okay, you know, like I loved the evolution. I love Tormund. Because like that's his man, you know. That's the only guy he ever really rides with. You know, he never fucked a bear. He didn't fuck a bear. I love it. I love me some
giant Spain bear fucker. Yeah, he's
love that he wants Brienne so bad, but just does not get that he'll never have her. Just not her cup of tea, Tormund. But yeah, so I got Tormund at 4.
Man, we're going on quite the streak of redheads here. We had Melisandre to Tormund. Not quite, you know. I think it's sort of red, or maybe it's just a streak of red. But Jack and Hagar is my is my number 3. So we're going on quite the red streak here. But and who knows? Jack and Hagar is actually I guess this is actually no one here.
Yeah, we don't even know who he is.
Is this how many no ones are there? We don't know. Is there only one? Can they be in multiple places at multiple times? Is Jockin the original no one? Is this, we don't know. And that's why he's my number 3, is that he is so mysterious and that he is just, you know, the little grin he gives Arya on, like when she leaves, is it just that he's proud of who she's become in the moment? Or is it like, perfect, you have completed your training, you know, like this is what is supposed to happen.
This is what you were meant to do.
Yeah, if there is someone who's connected to the gods and, like, the deity, like, we had Melisandre, pretty connected, but more of, like, more of, like, when it needs to be done sort of thing is Melisandre. It's, like, it's at moments of extreme chaos in which she comes in and fixes things. But Jockin is kind of the slow burn, and it feels like he's way more connected, and I don't know, that's... There's just so much mystery surrounding him. The whole Arya House of Black and White storyline, I love. It's one of my favorites in the entire show. So Jockin is just a huge part of that. And I don't know, him just popping up and being like, three names, you know? Name me anyone. I got you. And I did forget about Tywin, I guess. So there was someone that he couldn't get. Which is interesting, but no, I had to get Jockin in here. Now that I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe I could have switched 3 and 4, but Melisandre and Jockin are pretty interchangeable for me. Melisandre just kind of got in here for that new lens of the rewatch that I had with the whole Lord of Light and deity side, but Jockin has always been kind of an interesting character to me from the jump. Theories out the ass surrounding Jockin. So,
is Jockin Serio, et cetera. Same guy? Question mark? Don't know. Maybe.
We don't know. Melisandre throwing out that line, you know, of the Serio line. Is Melisandre Jockin Hagar and Serio Pharrell?
Big thoughts.
Now we're getting somewhere, but now I'll stop.
I love that. That's a good choice. That's a great choice. I love it. My three, limited to a couple seasons here. And again, a John supporting character, another redhead. Ygritte. I'm going Ygritte here. Loved Ygritte. Rose Leslie was so fucking good at playing Ygritte. She was immediately one of the most likable characters that was presented in the show. And again, just the way that she forces John to evolve, and the way that she evolves herself in that time, but can't let herself commit fully to this complete, like, she doesn't get to the point that Tormund gets to. She doesn't get the chance to. Her life's cut short by Ollie, my least favorite supporting character.
Fuck. We had a top five for worst characters. Ollie's in there. Fuck that
Ollie's
guy.
Ollie's in there. Fuck Ollie.
So much chemistry that they got married. You know, it's got to go. You got to. I don't think it's 100% the show's doing, you know, not even close to majority of the show's doing. I'd say it's just the real life chemistry, obviously, that they just had. But this is where they met, right? They wouldn't have met otherwise. So
gotta give it some credit, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty freaking cool.
And they perform their asses off across from each other. Absolutely, one of my favorite seasons of the show is the season where their relationship just flourishes. I believe that's season 4. Probably my favorite season of the show.
Man, it's happy moments with them. You know, it's like just the true good relationships in the show. They're in the cave. He's doing the thing, and I don't know when it comes back up. But like, does Ygritte say something like, "Where'd you learn to do the thing with your tongue," or whatever? And John's just, did what I thought was right, you know, or whatever he says. Like, they're, I don't know, everything they say is just so cute, and just in a show where you get beheadings and Battle of the Bastards, you know, people just dying left and right, gore and bad shit. At least we have a good romance, you know,
Kissed by Fire and followed by The Climb. A couple of great episodes for them. Adore them. So, yeah, I loved Ygritte. Had to get her in here. She's my three.
Okay. Well, we are on the redhead streak. Tormund, Melisandre, Ygritte, Jockin Hagar. Maybe. We don't know if my next character is a redhead or not, and that is because we never see a hair on his body ever, and that is Varys. Varys is my number two. And I think Varys is just a more of like the concept of the character for me. I love his outlook on he will always protect the realm. You know, he pushes all of his selfish desires and everything away, and he always protects the realm. And he was right at the end of season 8. You know, he's saying he's hoping he's not right, but he was willing to die for his beliefs and what he believed in. And man, yeah, this wish the other advisors would have taken Varys' sacrifice a little more, with a little more substance, you know, a little more like, he did die for this.
That's what
okay.
He said, he meant the shit, you know?
Yeah. So, but man, another one I love to theorize about, the purpose that he's bald is he can't show his perfect blonde or white Targaryen hair. You know, I love to think that everyone's a Targaryen.
Yeah.
But no, Varys doesn't need any of that. He's he is the true from the ground up. You know, man came from nothing. Honestly, was dealt a pretty shitty hand from his childhood. Yeah. If his story is to be believed, and I'm going to take it at face value.
Pretty sure it is.
He is the master of whispers, and lying is kind of his whole shit. So like,
Red Woman kind of confirms it though.
But that's true. That is fair.
Red Woman does.
Yeah. Okay. The actual like top dog, right? Like the Pope of like the Red Woman, like the Red Priestess.
High priestess or something like that.
But Varys, I don't know, made his way all the way to the top. Could have been ruling the New World. Would have for sure been in that council if he made it out. If Daenerys,
they'd have an easy master of whispers. That's one of the positions.
Oh man, there's no replacement for him, and that's why. You know, Bran strolls in. He's like, "Hey, notice this seat's vacant. We did just lose the greatest." The greatest master of whispers that's ever existed. Crazy to think that he was the elder at the time. Him and Davos are really the only elders, which is crazy.
Insane.
Great
character. Love Varys. And just such a good dude. My two, I'm going another honorable some bitch, incredibly selfless, is always giving her sword to service those around her. I'm going Brienne of Tarth for a top two favorite supporting character. Absolutely love Gwendolyn Christie, one of the most talented women alive as far as acting prowess. I think that she doesn't get a chance to show off as much as I would have loved for her to show off, but when she does, god damn is she good, man. I love Brienne of Tarth, and I think that there are a few characters, you know, she's in that tier. She's in that Jon, Ned, Varys. Those are her compatriots when it comes to how good she is, you know, and she's incredible. So I absolutely adored Brienne, and I think that
not Brienne, as some would say,
the audiobook narrator.
And D&D also have some crazy pronunciations of their characters, like Melisandre. I remember was like I forgot. Oh my god, it was just so different. And then Missandei as well was like Miss. It's crazy how they. I don't know. I forgot how they said it, but like I don't know. Brienne was one that I always remembered, but I forgot it was the audiobook, not D&D. Okay.
Yeah, no, that was an audiobook one. Brienne. Mm. There were a few others that I can't remember off the top of my head, but that's the most egregious one. Her name's Brienne.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking obvious. I don't know how on earth you could read it and go, this name's Brienne.
I guess maybe that's just English, you know? That's just technically you could, like, if you wanted to, you could make it sound like that because it's spelled that way, but.
No, I mean, like, you obviously can. I get where he's coming from, but the name's Brienne.
Yeah. I mean, the word grape, I can make sound like grape. But it's
now,
not
it'd be
grape.
One. It'd be one thing if it was like Brienne. No, that's Brienne. This is Brienne.
Yeah,
that makes it a soft e. And it does not make it
no
one.
Shot. It's a hard, yeah.
Brienne.
Mm-hmm.
Pisses me off. Sorry.
The first female knight. Is this true?
Yes, the first is woman knight.
Not even a dame.
They do not call her a dame. They call her sir, which I think is funny. It's quite literally what she is a dame. But I appreciate that.
It's the first though. Maybe they like haven't they're come like, up with that yet, you know? We're like, well, we don't have a word for that yet. So sir, you know,
sir Brienne of Tarth.
Yeah, gotta go.
No gripes there. Just a funny could've, little detail.
Yeah, for the first, they could have, that. Like, Tyrion was like, why don't we pick one? Why, like, it's like, well, sir doesn't feel right. Why not? Yeah, I don't
dame
know.
Dame Brienne of Tarth.
Yeah,
like,
could have been a perfect.
Hard.
Yeah, could have been perfect.
Hard. So I do enjoy Brienne a great deal. I think that her and Arya, their little kinship that they form briefly is really satisfying. Her and Sansa is obviously very satisfying and probably the most satisfying is her and Catelyn. Sorry to say that her and Jamie's story ends so terribly that their evolution couldn't be fully realized. But love Brienne. Mm-hmm. I adore her, so she had to be top mm-hmm. two.
All right. And she'll come back around in duos eventually, whenever we get there. But on to number one, my number one dude, the biggest hype man. You know, Tormund's a pretty good hype man, and I do love him for his hype man abilities. But there is one that hypes Jon up like no other, and that's Davos. Davos Seaworth. And not, you know what? I don't even want to say just because he's Jon's hype man, because he's only Jon's hype man late in the game. You know, he's with Stannis for a fucking long ass time, and goes on his own wild adventures, pirate adventures, smuggles Gendry, you know, gets him safe and in King's Landing, and then gets him back into the game. You know, that's what I was just gonna say. Yeah, he's just one of the coolest characters that we don't get enough of for what, you know, the game, the coolest name in the entire show. You know, he's a pirate and friends with Dob. Like, I wish we could have gotten a little more. That's okay. But no, Davos is, he's just a ripe old, you don't get to a ripe old age like I do, you know. I love his accent, you know, yeah. And,
nobody listened to me. All I ever did was get to a ripe old age.
Or what does he say when it's like, I'm sorry for what you're about to witness, or like whenever he pulls his sword. Kent, like it,
I've never been much of a fighter. Apologies for what you're about to see. I absolutely love
God,
him.
God, he's like, why is he? He just
this
fits
the trade.
Perfect. Yeah,
this was the trade. We our top ones. It was like, well, one of us is going to have one of them. The other is going to have the other. Davos is absolutely. I won't lie. Probably my favorite supporting character in the entire show. Like he's right there with my one. Mm. I absolutely adore him. I think that Liam Cunningham plays him with such fucking clever, witty presence that it's unbelievable that Liam Cunningham isn't in more stuff. You know, I want him in everything. I love Davos, and I love Liam as a mm-hmm. as an actor. And I think that he's actually in that movie, Breakfast on Pluto, that I told you about, the Cillian Murphy.
Yeah,
he's in that movie.
Man,
he's like a biker in that movie. He's
in that new D&D show, right? And that's maybe not.
Yes, he is in the Three Body Problem, I believe. Pretty sure he was also in that vampire, like Dracula on a boat movie. I don't know if you remember that. The Last Voyage of the Dementor or whatever.
That's out? That's not like. Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought that was coming out eventually.
No, yeah, that was long out. I believe he's in that too. So
he loves the boats. Yeah, he's a pirate at heart. You know,
smuggler.
He's just a smuggler. Yeah, if you're a famous smuggler, you're not doing it right.
So that's a fantastic top one. Jealous indeed. But I've got a great top one. My top one is I love them. I love them dearly. They are absolutely my top two. On any given day, it's hard to tell you who my favorite is between Davos and this guy. But I'm going Sandor Clegane the Hound. I absolutely adore his evolution. Probably the one of the most clean cut, fulfilling arcs in the entire series. Going from the dog, the man who follows every whim of Joffrey and the king, and specifically Joffrey, being his bodyguard, not even on the king's guard or not even a knight. He's not Sir Sandor, he is just Sandor Clegane. And to watch him, you know, fuck the king,
God, man,
protect Arya, you know, befriend her and grow with her, and then get nearly killed by Brienne and take after brother Rey, be in that group, grow even more. And then once they die, just devote himself to protecting the good in people and getting his vengeance against his brother. Those are his priorities, protecting the living and killing them out. And I think
looking back at his arc, it is Like
one of the most complete arcs in the entire show.
It might be the, like, John is pretty fucking good. You know?
I'm like, I love Davos. Like, I don't think he has nearly as clean cut and concise
an arc
as Davos.
He learns lessons from Stannis, and like he has like his relationship with Shireen, and then gets pissed at Melisandre. You know, he does go on things, but like never like it's still he knows who he is. Like Davos, he's
sounds always on a rough footing with himself. Yeah. There's a lot of self-hatred. There's a lot of...
He's, like, actually finding himself. Like, he's actually, like, on a journey.
And it's cool to think about how both of their stories interact so deeply with deities that they do not observe.
Yeah. You
know, Davos is not a devout man. He makes that clear. He does not believe in the Lord of Light. He doesn't believe in any of this shit. So, but he sees things that is like, it's obviously there. It's obviously real. You can't deny it.
Deny that.
The Hound goes through the exact same shit. You know, he goes through exactly the same, like, he doesn't believe in that shit, but he looks into the fire and he sees the message and it's like,
yep.
Well, something's there, you know?
It's weird. It is strange. The, apparently the more you study science, just in general, you start out very, very anti-religion and you are certain of it. And then the further you go on, the more and more you slightly become more and more. You see it more, but it's not in the way that you think. And it's strange that I'm seeing that a little bit. Like I'm still not fully there myself, but it's weird how I'm like, but, damn, there's some things I can't really deny, you know.
Science can't explain everything, which is kind of like that's the thing that should be able to explain everything.
And like The Hound had like the, you know, he kind of gave up. He's like, the world's shit anyways. It's a doggy, you know, it fend for yourself. It's free, you know, all kind of shit. He was down in the dumps, you know, very pessimistic view. And then now it's, you know, there is a purpose for him. He does have to protect Arya at the end, you know, when Beric is like, hey, what about her? You know, if you're done, whatever, but like, what about her? And what are you going to do? And then he's like, well, shit, instantly goes and defends her. So yeah, the Hound, you said it was, you know, you were you didn't like having Davos not on there, but these are one and two. Like there's really no question there. They're one and two for different reasons, but the best, probably one of the best arcs in the entire show does go to the Hound, which is crazy to look back and think, but very true. So, yeah, so think a fitting one
back. What were your top five favorite supporting characters?
I had at 5, Olenna Tyrell, 4, Melisandre, 3, Jaqen H'ghar, 2, Varys, and 1, Davos Seaworth.
Beautiful. And I had at 5, Oberyn Martell, at 4, Tormund Giantsbane, at 3, Ygritte, at 2, Brienne of Tarth, and at 1, Sandor Clegane. Let's move on to the top 5 performances, where once more we have an overlapping category. And this was pretty easy. I'm pretty sure this pretty closely follows our mathematic results of the numbers as far as what we ended up giving everybody throughout the course of the show.
I think there's only one switch, actually.
I believe there is too.
But
at 5, we'll take it in with Sophie Turner. As Sansa Stark, a brilliant performer, and the way that she evolves as a performer with her character and grows as an actress as her character does is fucking astounding. Like, the casting department could not have gotten luckier.
Like, the age and like just her growing, like in real life, like, it was perfect.
I think she's the best example of it, but I mean, Maisie Williams. Unbelievable that she ends up being as good an actress as she does. Isaac Hempstead, right? Obviously gets shoehorned into a role where he doesn't have to perform as much, but he's still good at it. You know, like, the way that they casted these kids as young children and then getting to see them grow into very good actors. I think Sophie Turner defines that for this show better than anybody. And goddamn, was she good.
Yeah. I mean, another arc that is very, very satisfying to see her go on. Very complete. And you get that coming of age because she is that is her character at the beginning. She is that innocent child who has lived in Winterfell her whole life, who is, you know, just not seen the real world, who Ned, you know, women at the time, that's just kind of what they did in castles. They didn't really know anything, but then, you know, going on with, she just isn't with the right crowd a lot of the time, you know, it's not good, but whenever she starts becoming confident in herself, and not to say that her performance is bad before, like, it is still good, her being the frightened child and the scared and anxious, you know, performance she has to put on, but I love the, when she becomes Sansa Stark and she is like, you know, confident in her ways and everything, that's when I really, really love her performance. But yeah, it's very fitting for 5, that's for sure. She deserved to be up here, and yeah, I guess the next closest ones out, Michelle Fairley, Macy Williams, Sean Bean, are like
Starks.
The next three. So yeah, we have all the Starks right outside. So that's very, very fitting.
Yeah, no, I loved Michelle Fairley, and she was one of those ones that was like, if we'd done two separate lists, would have crept into this for sure. But when it comes to just 5, there's just 5 just brilliant fucking performances. This was one that didn't even feel difficult for us. We just listed them, and that was it. So Sophie Turner, one of the no-brainers for us. Like, it was like, yeah, Sophie Turner's the 5th one. She's
Just 5. Kind of. The numbers actually make sense. Like, us just having the straight up performance nods for every episode in the show just actually does give us a very good insight. And number 4, you know, maybe if you ask me straight up, might come as a surprise that he's number 4, but then I look at everyone who's above him and it makes sense. But number 4 is Kit Harington, our boy, our top character, but our number 4 in performance. And it's, someone just has to be 4. It's not like he's bad because he's near the bottom of the list. Whatsoever. But yeah, it is just crazy to see him. Like, it's crazy that John Lowe is a 4. He's in the top 4, and that still
that's what's crazy about the character and the performance that Kit puts on, is that I think that everybody else on this list, I feel like, does big emotions better. They just get a chance to do big emotions more. Even Sophie Turner, who we have below her. There are very few at playing subtlety quite as good as Kit Harington does.
Yeah.
There's a lot of moments in season 8. He does not get a lot to work with as a character or as a performer. But what he manages to do with that stuff is brilliant. You know, like a couple of my favorite scenes in season 8 of his are, you know, obviously learning his true heritage, the way that we just linger on him and show him reacting to the information. And then when Daenerys comes into his room in season 8, episode 4, and is like, you know, like, let's do this thing. We got this. And him like turning away and being like physically recoiled by it. Mm-hmm. Like, he's very good at that sort of stuff. So. I think
that little grin at the very end, man, that it felt like that was the biggest smile the North has ever seen. I swear to God, when I'm remembering back on that smile, and it's just the slightest little, you barely even see it, But yeah, it's all, I don't know, all in Kit. And I love how he,
and that's what's fascinating, is that, like, I don't even know that he does smile. It's an air that he's affecting. And to be able to do that with your face without smiling is fucking insane. Like, how are you capable of doing that? How are you able to just kind of move your face a little bit to the point where I can tell you are more happy than you've been in a very long time, but you're not grinning ear to ear? Like, that's, I don't know how that's possible. I don't know how you do that. So I take my hand off to you, to quote Mike Tyson.
He's at home. He is at home, and that, yeah, I don't know. In that one little grin, there's no more that I need, you know? That's it. Like, I actually don't want the spinoff. You know, I would like it, but, like, I'm good. John is just living his life.
The thing with the sequel series idea is, like, oh, so there's going to be another conflict?
Exactly.
I don't want that. I don't want that.
The North is fine now. Him and Tormund are, it's actually, they're
cool.
They're fine.
You know, like, I think a wildling faction's trying to takeover thing could be fun. Mm-hmm. Like a war against the Thens or something. That could be cool.
They still exist. I guess I forgot. Right? Like at large?
Like, yeah, I mean, like
up in the north somewhere? Like there's a camp of them somewhere? Is that a thing? Or were they all marching with them?
You know, like, yeah. I think that's part of the, like,
my grand,
when it comes to a sequel series, they would have to introduce elements that we wouldn't be able to trace
that
back.
It has to be something new completely. Yeah. And
so,
but I don't know.
That's why I'm like, rather, I think that's, there's a lot of good opportunity, but they're not going to play with it. I don't think they're ever going to play with it, but
just,
yeah,
let
Kit Harington, man.
Let me headcanon it all. You know, Kit is up there. He's in his post show heaven, you know, in his honeymoon. He's been through the shit. Mm-hmm. Let him have his like afterlife, you know. Like let him actually die. Let the character actually die. But,
our boy Kit, man, I loved Kit Harington in the show. He was so damn good. And another guy who pretty much every single performer on this show, just when it came to season 8, deserved better. Like everybody is shortchanged. Everybody is shortchanged, and that is terrible. I don't know how you manage that. And one of the ones who is the most shortchanged of all of these people managed to succeed despite the odds in season 8. They're given this material, they're given this stuff to work with, and they're like, how do I elevate this at all? And I think that Sophie Turner and Kit Harington did a very good job, and a guy who probably did the second best with having to elevate material in season 8, Peter Dinklage as Tyrion Lannister at hour 3.
Talk about let's give you the worst of the worst writing. Like maybe it's meant for him to fail a lot, you know, but I mean, he fails at everything
a point where it's out of character.
Yeah. Like it's,
you know,
And at the end, they spin it as, like, we will learn from our failure. But they don't even go there. It's like, no, just the memories and whatever. It's more what you wanted. So it's like,
yeah.
They don't actually go there, which is crazy. But, yeah. Before then, though, undeniably, he's got the humor. He's got the wit. He's got, you know.
I'd say that if we are picking a single episode for the greatest performance in Thrones, it belongs to Peter Dinklage. I think it's his trial episode is the best anyone ever performs in this entire show.
I could be the monster you think I am, or whatever the oh my god, yeah, that trial is. It's honestly like that's the thing with Peter Dinklage is like a lot of his lines. There's a lot of like. Actors obviously pull through like their real experiences when they're performing, but I feel like there's moments in the show that they give him that are like therapy moments, like almost like it's like, hey, just let go, man. You know, like, I don't know. Like this is, I don't know. You're on a stand. You're on your pedestal right now. You know, you're kind of like go on your soapbox, go off, man. And I don't think Peter Dinklage is a monster in real life and he would poison the well of all of us, you know, and all this stuff. I don't know. I thought
you're drawing from real emotions to create emotions.
Yeah. It, man, like he does such a great job making me just feel everything that he is feeling. And he's as far as the comedy goes in the show, there's a lot of Thrones comedy that's not like strictly comedic in the stereotypical sense, but Tyrion is that kind of. All the time, like he is the consistent comedic tone from the show, but definitely knows when to get serious whenever it's needed as well. There's never like it's never harsh him going back and forth between like comedy and in serious mode. It's always, you always know what you're getting with Peter Dinklage, and I think that's why it, you know, he got that bump above Kit, is that like every time he's on screen, it's crystal clear what is going through Tyrion's head. Like,
I think it was crystal clear who our top 5 was, but I think it was even more crystal clear who our top 3 was. Like our top 3 are our top 3. And Peter Dinklage, he's in that tier, man. Like he's a cut above everyone else except for a couple people. And that'll bring us to our 2, who I mentioned Peter Dinklage being the second best at elevating the material in season 8.
Yeah.
The absolute best at elevating the material in season 8 is Emilia Clarke as Daenerys Targaryen.
Yeah, saying that Tyrion got a shit hand dealt to him. Oh boy, did Emilia Clarke get a shit a lot of things dealt to her. Yeah, and you're right. They're without a doubt made the most of what she had. But even, you know, before that too. It is, you know, I'm doing a lot of that. I'm doing a lot of before seasons 8 and a little bit of 7. Man, it was, she's speaking another language a lot of the times, you know, and it's never, yeah, never, yeah, not even a real language. Yeah, that's true. Dothraki, Valyrian.
And Dothraki.
Oh my god, yeah, so it's like, what the fuck? And it's kind of like, I noticed it in Dune as well, where it's like, when the performance is that good in another language, you kind of hear it in your own language. Like, I remember hearing "Long Live the Fighters" straight up. Like, I thought Timothy said "Long Live the Fighters." It's not at all in English. And like, I feel like I remember some Daenerys lines, where like I could have sworn it was in English, but no, it's completely in Dothraki or Valyrian. Dracarys is very Dracarys, you know, that's pretty clear. But I swear, some of her, just whenever she's addressing everybody or giving a big monologue, I could have sworn she's just speaking English. Yeah. And it's another facial, like her facial acting is incredible. Like, just how her, like, she can cry so well. I don't like her sadness or anger or the face twitch she does, whenever she's like about to go, you know, when the bells are ringing, man,
she has top 2 eyebrows in all of movies and cinema and television.
Ooh.
The way Colin Farrell is the other one, by the way, not in the show. Great, great eyebrows. And I mean, just the way they are able to express themselves with their eyebrows. You can literally look up Colin Farrell and Emilia Clarke, and this will be a subject. People will talk about this.
I've seen the memes of Emilia Clarke. I have not been into Colin Farrell yet. I've never seen him, but now I just looked up Colin Farrell eyebrows, and yeah, no, I'm seeing it now.
They do that thing where their eyebrows tilt all the way up. Yeah. I don't even know how that's possible. Do that thing. It's incredible.
How the hell?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
That's some Jim Carrey level of facial contortion. Like,
yeah, wow. Yeah, no. But there are so many moments where, I mean, like, her eyes obviously do a lot of expressing. There's a line in The Personal History of David Copperfield where young Davy says, he has 2 eyebrows, and I mention his eyebrows because they're much more important to his face. You know, like, there are moments where her eyes and her eyebrows are working together to create such a fucking heavy emotion that, like, it's whenever she's talking to Kit Harington in her final scene, she's doing this squint thing the whole time. She's contorting her face to where, like, it's, she seems so meaningful. She seems so genuine that it's, I don't know how you achieve that through just your face. And, she's utterly brilliant, man. I absolutely adored Emilia Clarke, and I don't think there is literally only one other actress in the show who I think is worthy of being put on the same pedestal as her, and we did. She's our number one.
Yeah.
Which
One more nod than Emilia Clarke. Emilia Clarke got 19. Lena Headey got 20. Yeah, it was, this one I think was the clear one. We were like, well, we have the numbers. He is number one, but I think we knew this already too. We were like, yeah, no, this, just when it comes to acting prowess and just being on screen and just dominating every time. Yeah, like playing the character. I would like to say that a lot of it was like written in and like this is purposeful, but like I wonder how much of it was Lena Headey just. Like, I wonder how much of it wasn't direction and just her knowing the character at a certain point.
Well, there's so much that she's able to do. I mentioned Kit Harington being really good at subtlety. She's the other one that really, really fucks that up, because she's brilliant with big emotions. Whenever mm-hmm. she feels deeply, she feels deeply. But what she's so good at is masking those emotions while letting those emotions brim to the surface and settling under a sheen of deception where she is masking those emotions for something else. But you can tell what the emotion is that she's feeling.
And every layer of the game. Every layer of the game you get through her. Yeah, like it's... It is crazy that, like, there is so much story going on that, like, the actors have to, like, they have to know all of those interconnect, like, who they're talking to at the time and, like, what, get, I don't know, how that'll affect their character's future, you know, or whatever. It doesn't matter to them at the time. It's just the job they're doing. But, like, that it's always crazy to put myself in an actor's shoes and be like, okay, I have to turn on Cersei Lannister for work, and then go back home and have dinner with my family and go to bed and act like a normal human. And yeah. But she does it flawlessly. I mean,
she's fucking brilliant, man. She's so goddamn good.
There's in there, like, the other performers, like, there are episodes in which they're not bad, but it's just kind of like, okay, for the standard we know in which you can reach, this wasn't your strongest episode, but, like, I don't know if there's really one time Lena Headey was not, like, at just the top of her game. Like, I don't know. Her scenes always are very powerful. I don't know. Yeah, and she is the queen.
She's the best.
Or some of it, you know, so. But
I mean, she's the queen for the last two seasons.
Mm-hmm. Damn. And then arguably...
For six.
Arguably, before those as well, she's the one pulling all the strings for Joffrey and Tommen is, you know, so, like, she's been in whenever even Robert's on the throne in season one.
I'd say she was better at pulling strings when Robert was king. Like, her whole thing with Joffrey was that she was incapable.
That's true.
Pulling strings.
Yeah, that's when she started going. Yeah, that's why she started going crazy.
She tries to overcome it, but mm-hmm. then Tommen becomes king, and she can't pull the strings there because Margaery. So there becomes, like, this, like, helpless thing. And I think that she does just so fucking good at it. I love Lena Headey, and she rounded out to be our top one performer in all of Game of Thrones. So with that, our top five performances were Sophie Turner at 5, Kit Harington at 4, Peter Dinklage at 3, Emilia Clarke at 2, and Lena Headey at 1. Now let's dig into some duos. These are character duos, your favorite relationship dynamics in the entirety of the show. Let's go ahead and bring it on in.
Yeah.
You go ahead and kick us off with number 5.
And these are a little more fun, you know. I not so much thought was really thrown in that, like, oh, this, it has to be over, you know, this, I have to include this person sort of thing. This was, I don't know, sort of just my general, these are my favorites sort of thing. And number 5 for me was Brienne and Podrick. And I think an underrated, a slept on duo in the show that, like, Podrick's arc that he goes on of, like, teaching Brienne to be a little more chill and, like, hey, like, life isn't so, you know, neat and by the book everything and, you know, take a chance to take some compliments and look at what you've done, Brienne. And then also Brienne teaching Podrick how to fight and everything like that. And I don't know, just the adventures they go on, whenever they're trying to protect Sansa or trying to find Sansa, and it's like, hey, light the candle, and they're just waiting out there for Sansa to light the candle. You know, Brienne's just being her honorable self, and Podrick's just the guy that has to tag along. But I don't know. Podrick is also a good guy in his own right. So I love both the characters, and you got Brienne up in supporting characters. So I felt like it was a nice way for me to get Podrick and Brienne. In hearing,
yeah, fuck yeah.
In duos, so yeah, I got the God Rod Pod, up in here. Had to get him in, but
yeah, I kind of took advantage of the fact that, you know, you took Davos, in the supporting character, so I had to get him in mm-hmm. duo. So for my 5, I have Davos Seaworth and Shireen Baratheon. Just one of the more sad and moving relationships in the entire show. When he loses his son and he gains a daughter, essentially cares more for her than Stannis himself does.
Learns to read, you know, like a little bit from her, and like the little wooden stag, you know, that he gives her. And then that's how he finds it. And he's like, yo, what the fuck is this? And then it's like, oh, fuck. And it is very tragic. But while
I love their relationship, I think that their dynamic is adorable. I think that to have so much like paternal chemistry, as like it, they felt like father and daughter. And I think that they did such a fantastic job at that. So I had to give them a little love here. They were my five.
Yeah. The Nigget. Is that right? Like Knight? Yeah, Knight has a G in it? Yeah. How does Knight have a G in it or whatever? But okay. That's a good, a cute. That's very nice. But, at four, went a little, off the wall here, maybe out of left field a little bit, but not really. This is, Dany, Daenerys, and Drogon. Definitely her favorite child. That's for sure. You're not supposed to pick favorites, but this one's pretty clear. This is the favorite, the one that eats the most, I guess, the biggest one, the one that's not put in the cage, the one that's just kind of like, fuck it, I'm just going to go off, do my own thing. But, you know, we always had that kind of inside joke of they have this brain connection, or they have like a prep talk, you know, before they have a moment where it's like, okay, Drogon, this is where you come in. After I say this, then you're going to look all menacing and scary, and then you're going to come in. It'll be perfect. It'll hit way more dramatically. But it's just that kind of blood bond they got, you know. And it's sad to see Drogon have to be the weapon of mass destruction at the end there. But I did love the moment of him burning down the Iron Throne. That was very nice. One of a nice little... on this watch, a lot nicer on this watch than I remembered. So I don't know. I had to get Drogon in here somewhere. So I figured, why not? The duo, it did end up being quite the dangerous one at the end. But before then, when he was just a little cute little boy, he was, you know, thinking back to when he was just a little baby baby. But no longer that baby anymore.
Sad ending. Whenever, and a little bit of that baby though. Whenever he like shoves his mom, he's like trying to wake her up.
Hello, wake up! Why are you not moving?
When he hugs her, whenever Jorah dies and stuff, that's very sweet. They got a couple good moments there.
Yeah.
I love me some Dany and Drogon, but I'm gonna stick with you in the Targaryen side of things. As my four is Grey Worm and Missandei. A relationship that ends up being a bit dangerous in its own right, as leads Grey Worm down a quite murderous path. But prior to that, however, I feel about the ending of Grey Worm's arc, I don't love it. But I think that throughout the whole show, the connection they form and the romance they develop is extremely important to me. I'm a big I love romance, and three of my top four here are romances, and then my other two are like father-daughter relationships.
Yeah, so
like,
totally.
I have certain tropes that I really appreciate, these middle three are all romances, and I absolutely adore Grey Worm and Missandei's relationship. One of my top three favorite ships in the entire show. I think that their connection, their chemistry from Natalie Emanuel and Jacob Anderson is fucking palpable.
from the very early, you know, them bathing in the stream or whatever, and them looking at each other and being like, oh, you know, and then getting to you know, actually getting to action, and Dany being like, how does that work? Oh, I know
it does.
It does. I know it works. But just another good one. Another the ending. Yeah. A very good, happy relationship to see.
I loved them for a long time. So Grey Worm and Missandei are my four.
Okay. Well, this one, this quite the duo, the hype man and king, himself. I got Jon and Davos. I think this is more for Davos than it is for John. Just how much Davos hypes up John whenever he can. And even like my favorite moment really is whenever Davos is hyping him up in front of Daenerys. You know, cause Missandei did hype the fuck out of Daenerys right then, you know, give her all of her titles, and Davos was like, well, all right, here I go. And then, you know, he's going a little far. Yeah. He's
king of the North.
Yeah. And but then later on, you know, he's like, he took a knife in the heart for his people. And you know, John's like, Hey man, like let's slow it down. Okay. I don't know. I love their dynamic, and they're both just very wise and actual, like just very good leaders in the show. And
Davos,
I don't know,
is the reason John's alive.
That's true. It was like, hey, Red Woman, you got to get your shit together. You really like,
and that's him just betting on it.
Yeah, he's like, hey, you've done some shit before. I saw you birth a shadow monster that killed Stannis Baratheon. You got to be able to do something, right? Bring back the best guy that's ever lived.
Well, he doesn't even fucking know him at that point. Barely knows him.
Oh, John. Like, you mean like, yeah. He's like,
he seems like a good guy. I think he could do good. I feel like this is one of those guys we should bring back to life.
Wow. Oh my God. Davos, that dude with him holds it. Yeah. And holds it down.
Yeah. They'd been with him for close to a full season at that point, but it's, so they'd gotten to know him.
I guess, Stannis is gone. He has no clear leader. And it's like, well, if I'm going to pick someone, fuck, he's dead. I'd really wish he'd be alive. You know, this guy sounds really cool of what I've heard about him. And yeah, I'm going to protect his dead body. And if he was going to die doing it too, and it wasn't going to be pretty.
Gentlemen, never been much of a fighter. Apologies for what you're about to see. I love him.
He's so good. Oh, Davos. But yeah, that's my three, John and Davos.
Bet. I'm going to stick with you in the North here. Going with another one of my favorite romances in the entire show. This is where I'm going. Samwell, Tarly, and Gilly. Love Sam and Gilly, man. Their relationship. It's one of those ones, you know, is never in question. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a comfort to be taken in having a character like Sam, where there are a lot of characters where you're like, no way they kill that guy. Sam is like, there is no fucking way they kill that guy. You know?
No shot. Like, Ned was denial. No shot they kill him. But Sam is just actually like,
That's a low blow. You can't fucking kill Sam. Especially once he has this relationship with Gilly. Once he's become the surrogate father for little Sam. Once all that's happened, it's kind of like he's off the table. And the fact that he survives everything just kind of proves that. It's just kind of like there's no fucking way he should have survived all of this. And the fact that he does is due to the fact that he has this love for these people. And I think that, you know, him and Gilly, I love the way that their relationship, you know, sparks up at Craster's Keep, and he helps her escape, and he kills a White Walker defending her, and all this stuff. Like, it's
the first to kill a White Walker at that.
Also, and killed Ben.
Yep.
At the Battle at the Wall.
He does.
He does a lot of great.
He cures Jor, freaking Grayscale. He cures Jor's. Yeah, first to do that in quite some
Without
time.
Gilly, we never learn that Jon is the natural son of Aegon and of Rhaegar.
Yeah.
You know,
they were
meant to be there together. They were meant to. So it's just
12,572 shits.
Yeah.
Steps. Actually, Sam, not shits. It was steps.
I don't know. They're, I don't know. A nice get from where Gilly was at the start. She's living quite the better life, you know, even though it still kind of shunned, you know, can't be in the Citadel, but is in the Citadel or isn't. Like, we don't really know. We don't got to think about that. It's just good. You know, that's why it just works, because Sam and Gilly are just, it's okay. We want that. So
had to have them. They're my three.
Okay. Well, my number two, he was my number two in supporting characters. So I don't know. Maybe that's a saying something, but I have Varys and Littlefinger here. Sort of for the yin yang, the, you know, just two titans going at it. Couldn't kind of in the same game, but very, very opposite thinking. One, chaos is a ladder, and the other is very, you know, I'll protect the realm, and if I have to die because of it, okay. Littlefinger is not going to die for the realm. He will kill the realm for him, I'd say. He would probably be King of the Ashes if that's what it meant. There's, you know, Daenerys was going to do that. If there's a guy that would, Joffrey, Littlefinger, the Mad King,
Ramsay, a lot of dudes.
Euron. Ollie,
yeah.
Fuck that kid. But anyway.
He'd be King of the Ashes, bro.
Yeah.
Varys
and Littlefinger, though. More of an early season duo here. That's, you know, in the later seasons, they're not really together a whole lot. But man, when they're in King's Landing and they have just their kind of, you know, back and forth, it's very passive aggressive. You know, it's not like, obvious, but it's obvious to them, you know, like, because it's just, that's their whole game. And I don't know, I loved that in the early seasons, and they both get some pretty tragic deaths. But yeah, I don't know. I loved their
very triumphant death, I would argue.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want him to die. You know, I don't want Varys to die. I want Littlefinger to die. I didn't want him to die in that way.
Really?
Well, by Arya, yes, but not in the way the story had to go.
Yeah, the story's shit, but the way that it culminates, his death is good. I like his death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, Arya going, I love that. And Sansa Simplicity. Being the one to sentence him. Love it. But just how it happened was meh. But yeah, and then Varys, another just like, I know it makes sense for Dany to kill him because it's just, that's her whole thing right now, but like, really, like.
And he was trying to poison her. Makes sense.
I mean, yeah, and he was sending out many, many.
Yeah, he was committing treason.
Yeah.
He was right, but he was committing treason. But yeah. Was he right because he was committing treason? Like, because he committed treason, did this push her further down that path? Her closest advisors are, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, that duo and the way they tried to make things happen. The key difference being Littlefinger doing his best to get to the throne and Varys doing his best to get the right person on the throne.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I loved it. I loved that that dichotomy between them. So that's a good two. That is. My two, I'm going with my favorite relationship in the entire series, my top one romance, and that is Jon and Ygritte. Nobody comes close for me. It's just them, man. Their romance and the way that it sparks and evolves and is short-lived. You know, like, we're talking a couple seasons here. They might meet in season two, I believe, when they go north of the wall. And, you know, that's kind of when that happens for Jon. But for it to carry out through really form in season three and, you know, hit its stride in season three and fall apart in season four, it's moving. It's magnificent chemistry between Kit Harington and Rose Leslie, and the way that they both inform each other and change each other, and but ultimately it's the right person, wrong time trope, and I'm a sucker for that trope, man. I love that trope.
No, and Ollie had to be the one. Without Ollie,
both of them.
Damn, that is true.
Yeah.
Maybe Ollie's just the wrong person, wrong time. You know? Like, maybe without Ollie, they actually work. And, like, then Jon doesn't get involved. Maybe he stays north, you know, and just fucks off. Like, everything else just doesn't matter. They stay in that cave forever, you know.
Should've stayed in that cave forever.
Man.
You didn't fuck a bear. You never fucked a bear. I love Ygritte, man. I love Ygritte. And I loved them together. I think that she broadened John's horizons in a way he never would have had his horizons broadened otherwise. He opens her mind in a way that, you know, at a different time in a different place might have been more effective, but she's a wildling, man. If she was still there at the end of season 8, we could have gotten the perfect ending, But then, you know, is John who he is? You know, like there's all sorts of stuff.
Oh man, I didn't even think. I guess he just burnt, like, he, there wasn't like a grave, you know, for her necessarily. He did burn her at like a weirwood or.
Yeah, at a
whatever pyre they're called. But like, if he visited, like, that's the final shot, like him visiting that, would have been that cool. For the last.
I think it could have undermined the relationship he'd formed with Danny, you know, to visit Ygritte's resting place. So it's just complicated. Like, you need to move on, you need to grow, you need to, you know, there's a lot there.
True.
I think that more than anything, I love John. John and Ygritte is always my favorite John ship, and John and Danny's not even my favorite Danny ship. So like, there's all relationships I would have had for them besides each other.
Yeah,
top two there, John and Ygritte.
All right, my number one. I think I did slot it in pretty quickly. It's just one of my favorite storylines in all of Thrones. This felt like the perfect place to get it in, and that's Arya and Jaqen H'ghar and Stereo Pharrell, if I can go there, you know, possibly. And who knows who else? We don't know. Could be everyone, literally.
Nobody
Ned
knows.
Stark could literally be no one. But no, I'll stick with Arya and Jaqen here. The House of Black and White, just I don't know, her having to throw all of her possessions away, just all the whole storyline of her getting started and Jaqen just being this mysterious dude, not giving her too much, but giving her enough to keep her in and keep her interested and just the training he gives her and everything and the lessons that she does learn over in Essos. And Braavos is just so cool. I love Braavos. Braavos is just one of my favorite locations in all of Thrones. Just, I love that they have this assassin religion. I don't know what to call it. Just, if you give this guy a coin and you name, I don't know what the how you name someone or what you have to do to get someone to die, but it's just a guarantee. It's just 100% it will happen. This person will die. Yeah, I love that that's just a thing, and it's only in Braavos. But they can kill anywhere in the world, though, really. It's just their headquarters is in Braavos for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just guess, yeah, no. I was going to throw the waif in there, but definitely we see them at the same time. So definitely cannot be, but... They can all access each. I don't want to get. I'm not going there. But at least I don't know. That is why I am a theorizer. It is what I like to do, and so that's why it is my number one duo. In the show,
they're a good duo, man.
Yeah.
That it's a weird kinship and respect that they form, but the one they do form is very moving. And I, for my top one, I also had to go with an Arya. Arya connection there. My favorite Arya relationship is the one she forms with the Hound. Arya Stark and the Hound is my top one duo of the entire show. I have no doubt.
This was the one I had to be okay letting go with. Yeah. I think we were like, okay, Arya and the Hound is one. Who's gonna get it? Like, there is not even a two to compare.
You were gracious enough to let me have it, which I was very, very appreciative of, because I absolutely adore it, man. I love Arya, I love the Hound, and their kinship and the way that it evolves and that respect that maintains throughout the whole time. One of my favorite Arya and the Hound moments is actually a moment when Arya's not even there, and it's when the Hound asks Brienne about her and is like, you know, what's, is she okay? What's she up to? And you know, who's protecting her? And Brienne says, you know, the only person who needs protecting is the one in her way. And the Hound goes, it's not going to be me. You know, like, I love that.
And it's so out of character for him to say that, but reason is because he says it. It's like instinct. It's like, it comes out of him. He just says it because his feelings.
He's grown for Brienne. You know, they had the same motivations. They both wanted what was best.
The only one to best him, you know, that his language before was fighting, and Brienne beat him in every single one, every way possible. So yeah, it was a wake up call for him, and that was a cute
and then
moment.
Obviously the culmination of both their arcs there in that final conversation in the Red Keep is the perfect ending to both of their stories to set her on a new path. Let her know that vengeance isn't the way. She shouldn't end up like him. He's too deep now. It's over. He's going to do it, but she shouldn't have to follow him down that road. And she turns around and calls him Sandor for the first time, not Hound or anything like that. And it's just, they're my top one. They're the top one. So let's go ahead and run through that one more time. What were your top five duos?
Got five, Brienne and Podrick. 4, Daenerys and Drogon. 3, Jon and Davos. 2, Varys and Littlefinger. And 1, Arya and Jaqen H'ghar. Maybe Cyrio Forel as well.
All right. Mine is at 5, Davos and Shireen. At 4, Grey Worm and Missandei. 3, Sam and Gilly. 2, Jon and Ygritte. And 1, Arya and the Hound. Let's get into the final category, our top 5 favorite episodes of the entire show, and this is another one where we have two separate lists. So, and what is your top? What is your fifth favorite episode?
All right, a lot of these happen to be the penultimates, usually, which I think makes sense. And I am starting off with one, and it is season 2, episode 9, Blackwater. I think. You know, there is the penultimate to come first is much more of a shock. But this, I felt like, was like the first holy shit kind of like grand spectacle of the show. I'm trying to think if there was like in one fell swoop, you know, big battle, big, huge thing other
this
than I think
first. This was the first. For sure.
I think it was. Yeah. And man, I mean, and it was also kind of like a surprise. You know, it was like, oh. You know, it was unexpected, you know, that it could light the water on fire as well. You know, like, it wasn't like a clear, like, oh, obviously they're going to just light the entire fleet on fire with wildfire. I don't know. I thought in the whole episode surprised me. I remember it was all at King's Landing, and that's all the episode was. But I remember being actually quite surprised by it and, like, liking the whole episode. And working. So yeah, it's you know, as far as the moments go, that is why it is number 5, like, kind of down there, is that it is just kind of the spectacle of it all, and it was the first of the kind. But they definitely get better at that. They do spectacles and grand things and then make it a very just good episode of television on top of that too, later on. But this one does that, but not quite to the standard as my other ones, but
I love that. I love that. A great fucking episode, a classic, the Siege of King's Landing, fucking wonderful. I absolutely adore it. But my 5 is, I've actually only got one penultimate episode, and it's a bit up the, track here. I tended to hover around the middle of a season as far as I can tell here. This is season 3, episode 6, The Climb at my 5. Just, it's the one where Ygritte, Jon, Tormund, and other wildlings climb the wall. First time and only time we ever really spend any time watching people do that. It's a great moment for Ygritte and Jon when they reach the top and they look out over the kingdoms and the north, and then turn to the greenery of the other side. Aside Ygritte, I don't know if she'd ever climbed the wall. I can't remember if that was a thing, but
I don't think so.
It's the first time she's seen green. And that's
how
just
good that would feel. How tired you'd be at the top, you know, and you just be like, like you're so tired, but then just to see that, you'd be like
having that Rey and the Force Awakens moment, you know, I never knew there was so much green in the whole galaxy. And it's just one planet, you know? And to parallel that and edit it along with the Chaos is a Ladder monologue, that is what's happening at the same time.
Oh,
Littlefinger talking to Varys in the throne room about the climb. getting up the ladder. Chaos
is a ladder. Man, Aiden Gillen. What a voice he puts on for Littlefinger. God, it's so good.
It's really that moment that makes it so memorable. It's one that sticks with me so hard. It's beautiful to look at. It's beautifully written. It's beautifully edited, wonderfully performed. And that's it's kind of everything I loved about the show. It mixed spectacle with the conversation, the important men and conversations in a room, you know, like it had both of those things. They shoved it into one scene. They edited it beautifully, performed it wonderfully. I loved it. So season 3, episode 6, The Climb for me at 5.
Okay. On 4, I had a different episode in here at first, from the same season. And it was The Mountain and the Viper at first, for like kind of the moment. The fight was very memorable, but then I'm like, wait a minute. Oberyn Martell dies. I don't like that. There's another moment in the season of someone who dies in which it's way better. In fact, maybe one of the best deaths in the entire show. And that's episode 2 of season 4, The Lion and the Rose, the Purple Wedding, as some will call it. Whenever Joffrey, finally, we get to say goodbye to Joffrey, and we hear his last breath. It's that step up from Blackwater for me. It was a moment, like we are killing the current king. But the whole episode was the suspense building the whole time. Like it's something we were building to something the whole time. We obviously know what's coming, on rewatch, but even I remember us saying like, man, like it was kind of nuts. Like just, I'm on the edge of my seat even the whole time knowing that he's gonna die and everything. But, I think was that next level up of having kind of a big event that's gonna happen and a huge thing that's gonna affect the entire show. But then also just make it a really good episode on top of that. So that's why I went with The Lion and the Rose.
A good one, man. A great one. Lena Headey gets to perform her ass off in that one. So gotta love that. My 4 is actually the first bit of Thrones I ever had the pleasure of seeing. My father was watching it, and I went up to his room to talk to him about something, and I just kind of sat at the foot of the bed and was like, whoa. Mine's season 5, episode 8,
yeah.
Hardhome. The Battle of Hardhome was the first thing from Game of Thrones I ever had the pleasure of seeing, and it was kind of the thing that made me go, oh, I'm going to watch this show, huh?
I need that. Yeah, whatever that is, I need more of it.
I didn't know what episode it was. I didn't know when it was going to happen. And I didn't watch it for like a year after I saw this. So like I'd even kind of forgotten about it. And then when it popped up on my first watch, I was like, oh, yeah. You know, I was like, oh, fuck, that's so cool. Hardhome, it will always have a very special place in my heart for being the first little bit of Thrones I ever got to see. Epic moment for Jon Snow. Remember my dad explaining to me like, yeah, that's Jon Snow. You know, like he's the shit.
You're going to love that guy.
You're going to like that guy. It's just such a great, massive moment for the show. Great character beats for both Jon and Tormund. And one of those moments that just makes me go, you know what? Fuck yes, John. When he goes, Night's Watch with me, and they march in the opposite way everyone is running from, like, dude, I fucking love it. I fucking love it. So Hardhome, extremely special, absolutely massive moment. I absolutely love it.
Is it wrong of me to hope that in my lifetime I am a part of a with me? You know, I don't want to be, because that means that I am about to go into battle. But I don't know. God damn, that would feel incredible. Talk about a moment that I definitely don't want to be a part of ever. and hate to even think of is my next episode. And it's another wedding. And it's the red one. This is the Reigns of Castamere. We're saying goodbye to some very, very loved ones. A mother, a father, a going to be new mother, and baby, a lot of the Stark army, Rob's wolf,
Grey Wind,
Yeah, just a lot of sad. But oh my God, I remember when watching for the first time at how I've never experienced anything like this. In any TV, movie, anything before. I was like, no. Ned was one thing, you know. Ned was fucked. But then to do this was just kind of like, okay, now I know what show I'm watching. Anything can happen at any point. There's nothing that is off the table. They don't give a fuck. Because Ned was the main character, but Rob, I mean, they were just playing him up. Rob was the guy. Rob was like kind of the John, the early John and the early Danny, and just, oh my God, you loved Rob. And then
just, the North.
Nope. One swift, strategic morale, you know, morale in question, maybe. Tywin doesn't give a fuck, and Walder Frey definitely doesn't give a fuck. They won there.
Definitely morally inept. Very terrible thing that happens here. I'll never forget when I showed the show to Emily. There were a couple moments, and this is one of them that I didn't prepare for, like, okay, so you need to know this. I prepared her for there's something that happens in season 3 that you really, really need to steel yourself up to. You need to be ready for your heart to be ripped out of your chest. It's going to be bad. And this mm-hmm. was one where it ended, and we had, you know, the silence that you just sit in for a second, where you're just like
yeah, you're kind of like looking around the room at like, wait, is life even real right now? You're like, what do I do next? How do I continue on?
There is nothing that is as special as watching Game of Thrones for the first time. Absolutely nothing you could watch for the first time. That is,
I did have
Game of Thrones.
A memory pop up on Snapchat a little bit ago of I recorded one of my friends watching The Red Wedding for the first time, and just a mouth open, you know, it was just a gasp. And then just they were frozen for the entirety of the time. I don't know, it's hilarious. Just and that song.
For not a soul to hear. Yeah,
If you hear that song, just hope your last name is Lannister.
Yeah, Lannisters and the face.
I guess
their gods.
Mm-hmm. Maybe unless you're Arya. Getting to play it for one last time for the Frey family. Did she play it for the Freys? Whenever?
I don't think she did. I think I was silent.
Maybe not. Maybe it was like just the action, not actually played in the in the room, but I think maybe D&D, like the show, the episode, might have been playing Reigns of Castamere.
Maybe. I can't remember.
His house was going
Reigns
by.
Reigns of Castamere, man. That's a good fucking episode. That's a good fucking episode. Mm-hmm. My three. I'm going classic with it. And so classic, it's the very first episode of the show. Season 1, episode 1, Winter is Coming. I had to get it in here somewhere. It's one of those episodes where you watch it, it ends, and you go, oh no, I'm in. Oh no, I'm in. This is fucking good. It's ballsy. It takes huge swings. It changed the game, you know, like there's television before it, there's television after it, you know.
You know, I guess I've been harping on like Ned being like the first death to be like, holy shit, this show's really like they can do anything they want.
Being pushed out of the towers, the first thing you go,
might have killed a kid. You don't even know if he's alive. Like he could have been dead. Episode 2, to learn that he's paralyzed or like in a coma, whatever, is kind of like, oh, okay, like phew. You know, like, oh, he didn't die. So, like, yeah, they're off the gate. They don't give a fuck. I guess I didn't really think about that. But, man, just the introductions. It is crazy to look back on this episode and picture Macy Williams and Sophie Turner's face, you know, as they're greeting, you know, Arya not being there at first and having to run and get there before everyone arrives.
And Robert Baratheon's still in the shit.
And that early look at Cersei as well. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's, man, a lot of those early showings. Yeah, it's crazy to look back and just think of all their faces and how different.
The first beast is fucking awesome. You know, the one that they have in their, I mean, the room that we come back to all the time.
Yeah, it used to be so much full of, so much more full of life and everything. The conflicts we had to worry about was a dire wolf that bit somebody, or you know, I guess a butcher's boy. You know, it's like, let's deal with that and not killing King's Landing, you know, and burning it down and everything. So
yeah, so yeah, season one, episode one. That's my three.
Simpler times, yeah, simpler times. Well, I guess not so much simpler times. Yeah, let's go to killing King's Landing, or at least part of it. The second worst act of killing in King's Landing, the Winds of Winter, when Cersei decides, you know what, I have had enough. Yeah, and
it's finale, baby.
I think this is an opportunity in which all of my enemies can go away in one fell swoop. And, you know, if we have to lose a pretty cool building with, you know, some of my family that's buried there, I guess, and, you know, whatever, that's okay. A very, very small price to pay, but man, the opening of this episode, the piano, like the song Winds of Winter as well. Oh my God. I think probably the best opening in the entire show.
Oh yeah.
Without a doubt, maybe one of the, just one of the best, just overall put together scenes. Just like it's long. I guess it's like 10 minutes maybe that like it's going on for, but like if you can count that a scene, man, I don't know. It's, I just, not a word was spoken really. Like I don't, like for a long ass time.
Yeah, no, that's the sequence that, you know, it's just, it's shelling. You know that music, you keep building, and it is so fucking good, dude.
When it reaches the full orchestra, yeah, too, and, like, it just goes, oh, my God. Yeah, no, it's...
Yeah, like, it really is just that and The Long Night for me, that whenever I think of the best... best music compositions, bum 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 ba dum, like it just fucking guts me. So
there you go.
It's those two for me. I absolutely love those musical compositions, but yeah, no, the Winds of Winter, that's a fucking episode right there, man.
Hmm. Yeah, and
that's
number
when
two.
John is revealed to be Lyanna's son. That's when
the big, yes,
he
the
gets
face
named King in the North. Like it's a big fucking episode, and it comes straight off the coattails of my number two, the Battle of the Bastards, season 6, episode 9. So we get the Battle of the Bastards, and then we get that episode, and it's just the best ending to a season you could ever ask for.
yeah, holy shit,
it's unbelievable, dude. I love the Battle of the Bastards. It's fascinating because it's, on paper, not as big a spectacle as other things. It's just so fucking gritty. It's so real. There's so many people. There's so much going on. It's so fucked.
God, the shield moment. He's just blocking every arrow from Ramsay and then just beating the fuck out of that guy. Oh my God, how satisfying is that?
An entire army. He's like, I'm gonna die here. This is it. You know, pulls out the sword. God damn, is it good. We had to say goodbye to Rickon. R.I.P.
We already did before. Yeah. And we basically already did. He wasn't in the show.
Sansa being the saving grace. Jon nearly getting trampled to death. It's just... A brutal episode of television that ends just so, so satisfyingly.
Yep.
With Sansa getting to feed Ramsay to the hounds. Yes.
And to see it, you know. And she got enough, you know, that's the thing. You would think you'd want to see every second of it, but she was like, you know what? I've got enough. She's like, I've seen what I've seen. I needed to see it.
They start eating. She's like, she turns away and she goes, you know what? No, not
wait a
yet.
Minute. Wait a minute.
I gotta get a little bit more in.
I need to see this. Okay, no, that is actually pretty fucking terrible. Okay. No,
I'm good though. This is great. She turns away, smiles, walks away. Yeah. No, I love it. It's a great Sansa episode. It's a great John episode. Mm. It's a great North episode. Yeah,
you put Sansa fucking Stark for your character for that episode.
Dude,
she's
a fucking shit.
Yeah.
The reason everything goes good in that episode. And
Kit does not win that. John does not win that battle.
I'm 5 for 5 as far as episodes where my moment, the thing that I'm referencing, is North. It's the North. I love the North. So
the North.
This was top two for sure.
Well, say goodbye to the North for my top one. I've been referencing it quite a few times in the show. The death that kind of shocks everybody, shocked the world, and probably one of the best just episodes that they've made. And it came out of season one. And that's Baelor. It's crazy that like the best episodes that they have made is either like it's either at the very beginning of the show or like the very end of the show. And there are some bangers 100% in the middle there. But overall, like Baelor was just, it looked so much better for some, like the vision, like they cranked it up to a 12 for this episode and just that final moment, like the build up to that. And then the sound kind of cutting out and having like Arya seeing the doves flying just the sheer, just terrible emotion that Sansa's going through, Joffrey like laughing in the background, Varys, you know, trying to like scramble to fix, like you see everybody like do like scram. It's just what a fucking moment. Like, holy shit. The sword's being drawn. It's ice, you know, you're like, what the fuck? Like, is it ice? Do they use ice to cut his head off?
Yeah.
Fuck. Damn it. I was hoping I was wrong, and that it was just some no-name sword. Maybe I'd rather it be ice, actually. I don't know. I'd rather it not happen. It shouldn't have happened. Fuck.
He does everything he was supposed to get sent to the wall, also. He confesses. He's ready to accept his sentence. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. Yep. I was treasonous. I wanted to be king. It is what it is. Send me to the wall. And Joffrey's like, you know what? Never mind. Kill his ass. Even Cersei didn't want that.
Yeah.
Even Cersei was like, Joffrey, wait a second. You know, like, that's Cersei we're talking about, you know? It's one of the best, if not the best episode of the show. This is the other one when I show you. The reason I prepped her so hard for the Red Wedding, as in like, okay, something is happening at the end of the show, is because I lied to her so fucking hard about something happening at the end of season one. I went, there's a net. Oh, he's great. He's good for like the whole show.
Oh, you kind of have to though, but like, yeah, like you kind of,
I love
to,
Ned, but... like, and this was one where he was inconsolable for like 15 minutes. I'm talking like we laid there and she fucking cried for a while. Okay. Like that's what this show does though. You know, like I remember doing the same thing the first time I watched, just being like, no.
Like it,
having to start the next one, seeing the blood drip from the sword, the severed head, and then pausing it and being like, fuck, you know, like,
yeah, like his head, it can go back on, right? Like they're, like even after he died, you're still like, it's, they're gonna like flash back, or like that was just in Joffrey's head, or like, right? Like this didn't happen.
Because they do the clean sweep of the sword at the end of episode 9. And then they cut to the Arya looking up at the doves. And then the episode ends. So you're just kind of like, wait, no.
You hear a noise, though, right?
Like, oh, you hear the...
There's a... Yeah. There's a... So, like, that's the thing that really gets you to go, that's... I didn't hear that. That was the sound of the sword missing.
Yeah,
and just going Someone through the air.
Stabbed the headsman right as he was swinging the sword on Ned.
Someone right? jumped in between Ned and the sword to sacrifice themselves. No,
so, exactly. Yeah. The denial, the levels you go through with that episode, it's unbelievable. Yeah, that is the, I would say, the best episode of this show. Baylor is unbelievable. And while my top one is my favorite episode of the show, and cinematically, it may be the best. Like, it's unbelievable. My top one is The Long Night, season 8, episode 3. This is spectacle personified as far as this show is concerned. I don't think there's anything that comes close to matching it as far as grandiosity. It's unbelievable. An achievement in direction for television that I think is, I don't know how you could possibly match it, in terms of scope and scale and importance for any given TV show. Like, it's just that big of a moment.
Seems that's what they were building to, you know. This is actually what they wanted to be, like, remembered for, you know, sort of thing. Like, this is the big event we'll build to, and
they were like, you know,
we'll give you this. Yeah, we'll give you this. We don't really know what to do afterwards.
And I have my gripes, and you can hear them on the episode we did on season 8, episode 3. Mm-hmm. But I fucking love it, man. This is one of my
barely any.
This is my favorite episode of Game of Thrones. If there's any episode of Game of Thrones that I will watch casually, it's this one. That I'm
John
like,
stares
I feel like,
down a dead dragon and screams at it.
Ready
Arya kills the Night King. Melisandre's just fucking on her shit. We don't like, she's not like, just comes in out of, you're right, she's not even in the season before, and or in the season at all until now, and just she's here doing her thing. Danny, you know, on a drag, like, there's dragons, there's the entire Dothraki army, just like, it's holy shit, the amount of things that happened, and then just the visuals of it is impeccable. And
it's unbelievable to look at. Fabian Wagner's photography of it, Miguel Sapochnik's direction of it, the performances, the tension that's built, the editing. It's just a fantastic episode of television. So it had to be my top one. And go ahead and run back through. What were your top 5 episodes from this show?
All right. I had 5, Blackwater. 4, The Lion and the Rose. 3, Reigns of Castamere. 2, Winds of Winter. And 1, Baylor for me.
Beautiful slate there. I went with The Climb at 5, Hard Home at 4, Winter is Coming at 3, Battle of the Bastards at 2, and The Long Night at 1. And with that, we conclude Winter is Blooming. If you would, head to patreon.com/pennybloompod, where you'll find over 50 hours of exclusive content, including all sorts of book reviews, comic book reviews, movie reviews, and the like. For $3 a month, you can support the podcast financially, which is huge because it costs me money and I don't make any off of it unless it's over there. Head to Twitter, follow at pennybloompod, follow on Instagram and TikTok at pennybloompodcast. 5-star rate and review wherever you might be listening, and to continue to download episodes. Been a rough one so far, I cannot lie. Downloads-wise, we've not been doing very successfully, not compared to the end of last year and even January this year. February and March, not too hot. April, hopefully it's doing a little better. But that would be a huge help. But yeah, man, it was a pleasure to discuss Game of Thrones for so long at such length with you, man. I'm so glad we committed to the project. At times, it was tough. It was tough to get through. Big commitment. But
done. In the paid bag. Off. Complete. The completionist in me. Oh my god. Like, it's like 100%ing a video game. I've gotten every achievement now. There's nothing more I could possibly do. I mean, I've counted all the Hodors. I've tracked the Arya kill list. I think we've done the show justice. And very, very, very proud of what we've done. It's made me a much better just viewer in general as well, over the span of this rewatch. So I do thank the show for that as well. But yeah, it's a bittersweet moment. I'm so glad that we are open up now and we can do, you know, until House of the Dragon comes around, and we'll cover it.
And that is, as it is today, the 13th anniversary of the very first episode of Game of Thrones, April 17th, 2011, was the first episode of Game of Thrones. And here we are, April 17th, 2024.
Would you look at that? Would you look at that? I mean,
everything happens the way it's supposed to. And exactly 2 months from today, we will be doing our first episode of House of the Dragon. June 17th is our first episode for season two of House of the Dragon. But a week before that, June 10th, we will be doing our House of the Dragon preview for season two. Mm-hmm. Me and Joe plan on rewatching season one, not for the podcast. We will not be doing that again. We already covered season one in its entirety as it was airing, but we do intend on rewatching season one ahead of season two, forming theories, discussing season one, and discussing what we expect in season two and where we hope things go a week before season two airs. So Game of Thrones content, while winter's blooming is dead, fire and bloom will rise. Mm-hmm. And that will be in just a couple months, come June. Summertime, it's House of the Dragon, it's The Acolyte. We got a lot to look forward to, and I'm so very excited. But yeah, this officially marks the conclusion of Winter is Blooming, and that is it's bittersweet, you know. Mm-hmm. And we did a little bit of that sign off with the last episode of the series, but it is tough, man. It's been like, I feel so accomplished to have done all of this for my favorite show of all time. So yeah, we're continuing our coverage of the Bad Batch on Fridays. That only has a couple weeks left into the beginning of the first week of May, so just a few episodes left there. I believe this week brings us season three, episode
13.
So we've only got 14 and 15 left. We got three episodes of The Bad Batch left. And that will be on Fridays. maybe four. Still cooking. But there's three episodes left for sure as of yet. But with the end of Game of Thrones and with The Bad Batch coming to a close here soon, we've only got a few. We've got a wide open month here in May, and in these last couple Mondays and Wednesdays of April. So, what you can expect on Mondays and Wednesdays for the next couple weeks is John Wick, baby. We're doing John Wick 1 through 4 on Monday, Wednesday. The next couple weeks, and then we're doing an action movie marathon for May on Mondays and Fridays. So very excited for the slate we've got there. We've got Akira, Die Hard, fucking Mad Max Fury Road, tons of good shit, all sorts of stuff. RRR, I believe, is in
Speed the Racer,
Speed,
the Raid,
Speed Racer, the Menu, the Raid, Sicario, and then on Wednesdays we begin our next actor spotlight after John Wick, and that is after Dev Patel and after John Wick here, in anticipation of Furiosa, a Mad Max. We will be doing an Anya Taylor-Joy spotlight, and we've already formally announced that with the conclusion of the Dev Patel spotlight, but I'm so very excited. We've got Emma, we've got The Menu, and we've got... Last Night in Soho. All of those in anticipation of Furiosa, with the action movie project culminating at point with Mad Max Road right before Furiosa, and yes it's perfect.
It's like where comic book project meets director / actor spotlight mix, and like it's like a fun month.
Couple little, you know, the Anya Taylor-Joy ones in the middle kind of throw a wrench into the whole action movie month. Emma's definitely not an action movie. Last Night in Soho and The Menu
we'll
have a little bit
breaks.
Of a thriller. You know, they have a little bit of a thriller thing to them, but not action-y.
We'll need some breaks from all the action.
Yes.
And it'll be nice every Wednesday.
That'll culminate after the action movie project in a top 10 action movies ever episode. So May is full. We've got that planned. We are on the roll now. We've got the next few months planned, and I'm so very excited. But yeah, with that, I was Colton Robertson. I was joined by Joseph George. Thank you very much, homie.
Oh, thank you for having me. And it is always a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and it's always a pleasure to have you. And remember, peace, love, and bloom, and winter is coming.